This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Is this Germany and is the year 1938? Now, you might be sitting there listening. Oh, Josh, how could you be so hyperbolic? How could you talk like that? America, of course, is not like Nazi-era Germany. And it's true, it's not. But how can you look, on the other hand, at what is currently happening on the most quote-unquote elite universities in America, the purported prestigious ivory tower bastions of the Ivy League and like-minded conspirators? How can you look at what is happening right now and conclude that this is anything other than a modern manifestation of the 1930s era Hitler Youth movement? We have moved so far beyond anything remotely resembling good faith argumentation about Middle East foreign policy. We are not talking about a one-state solution versus a two-state solution, the 1967 lines, whether or not what's happening in Judea and Samaria, aka the West Bank, is actually an occupation under the law of occupation. It's not, incidentally. Well, we're not talking about any of that right now. That is not the conversation happening on America's university campuses. Columbia University, people chanting, quote, "We are Hamas," quote, "Long live Hamas." Protesters on the doorsteps there of Columbia calling to, quote, "burn Tel Aviv to the ground." Again, this is not a debate over a one or a two-state solution. Tel Aviv, a liberal secular city, is going to be in Israeli hands under any future political settlement. You know, just this past Friday, a buddy in Dallas, Texas, texted me. One of the synagogues there put out notice that there were expected protests on Friday, pro-Hamas protesters, inside of a residential eruv. Now, I'm not going to get into the intricacies of Jewish law, but an eruv is essentially a legal loophole in Judaism that allows you to do certain things on the Sabbath where you wouldn't ordinarily be able to do them. It's basically where religious Jews live, is what I'm trying to say. And yet they say that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. So why are you going to shout in favor of a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization in a small religious neighborhood in Dallas, Texas? Don't give me this crap that what is happening on campuses is not the literal, legal, functional, moral, political, social descendant of the Nazi-era manifestation of the world's most ancient and intractable bigotry, that against the Jews. Don't tell me that. Cries all around campus, "Go back to Poland. No one wants you here." Well, that's funny. They didn't really want us in Poland either, as the case may be. You know, I saw this one text message that went viral on Twitter. The Orthodox rabbi at Columbia, little over a week ago, had to put out a distress signal just before the Passover holiday started, saying that it was time to leave campus. Go home was the message from the rabbi at Columbia. Columbia being a school, of course, that has a very large Jewish population, roughly 20 to 25% or so. They probably won't have that population there in just a couple years' time. But the rabbi puts out this message, and then this social media Twitter post went viral that I saw, where a mother is describing her husband's efforts to go evacuate, I use that word deliberately, evacuate their college freshman daughter, a Jewish girl, out of campus. And the woman, the mother that is describing her husband as barricading through a hostile mob that is spitting and saying, "Go back to Poland, you Jew." And she analogized the father evacuating the freshman daughter as equivalent to refugees fleeing a war zone. like the last boat out of Saigon in the mid-1970s. There are a lot of factors to blame here. It is a most noxious and toxic brew that has led us to this point. That has led us to the point where America's so-called elite institutions are literally the next generation of Hitler Youth. You have the chickens coming home to roost in the most visceral way possible of 1960s era cultural Marxism and genuine academic radicalism, the rise of the Frankfurt School, thinkers like Marcuse and Adorno. My buddy Chris Rufo had a great book on this very topic last year. So you have that. You have large-scale immigration and affirmative action trends working in combustible combination with one another to populate these universities with many people who simply do not share the most basic and rudimentary of Western values. I don't know how else to say it. There's really no other way to say it than that. And then, of course, you have the rise of the intersectionality mentality that artificially divides the entire world into this two-tier false dichotomy of oppressors and oppressed, whereby the Jews and the Jewish state of Israel somehow being this arch-villain oppressor. Kind of funny. Anyone who's ever read Jewish history or world history, for that matter, could tell you that the Jews are anything other than an oppressor, but these people are not exactly known for their intelligence, are they? And that is roughly how you get to this point, where you have so-called Gaza encampments rising up all around campus. These dirty, filthy, drug-addled, mentally ill thugs setting up literal camp on the campus lawns in support of a U.S.-recognized foreign terrorist organization. Now, it's not all bad. Some of the campuses have been handling it okay. At the University of Texas, for instance, Governor Greg Abbott is not playing any games. He's not messing around. He had the Texas Rangers there. He had state troopers there on the ground to disperse this crowd when it got out of hand. In Florida, where I live, the president of the University of Florida, Ben Sasse, the former U.S. senator from Nebraska, who is now the president in Gainesville, Florida, at the university, you know, he's not messing around. They sent out a notice, the University of Florida Division of Student Life, apprising the students there that if they are found setting up a camp in the so-called Gaza encampment zone, they will be found guilty of trespass and suspended from the university for 3 years. And employees, if employees participate, fired. Literally fired. That's how you do it. That is the only way in a situation like this to restore order. You do it by any means necessary. You suspend, you expel, you arrest, you prosecute, and as appropriate, you deport every single last one of the mini jihadist Osama bin Laden aspiring thugs now populating American university campuses like the vile infestation they are. You take swift and immediate action. Send in the National Guard if necessary. Again, these folks are the functional, legal, and moral successors to the Hitler Youth from the 1930s. And if they are that, then they are certainly the spiritual, functional, and legal descendants of the segregationists back in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, who under the auspices of then-Governor Orville Faubus tried to block desegregation at Little Rock Central High School. What did President Eisenhower do? Well, he sent in the 101st Airborne Division to secure civil rights under law. Right now, Jewish students across America are having their basic Title VI civil rights systemically violated. As Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said when he visited Columbia this past week, you have to secure the most basic civil rights. That's going to take prosecutions, it's going to take expulsions, it's going to take lawsuits, and yes, it's going to take the National Guard. But order must be restored on the American university campus at this point and the Hamas infestation must be uprooted and extirpated by any means necessary.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We are now 2 weeks into the first ever criminal trial of a former president of the United States who, oh, by the way, happens to be a current presidential candidate for a major political party once again in these United States. At the same time, that same former president was at the U.S. Supreme Court this past Thursday for the much anticipated oral argument in Trump versus United States, which is a question about the scope of the breadth and depth of presidential immunity from future criminal prosecution after those presidents have left office. So let's talk a little bit about the New York trial first, then we'll go to the Supreme Court, and then we'll tie it all together. The New York City case, as we have discussed on this program, is by far the most farcical of all of the criminal prosecutions currently brought against Donald Trump. And there are four prosecutions, two federal, two state. The New York City one is a state prosecution. It is an absolute appalling joke. The allegations are that there were 34 separate instances of bookkeeping fraud. That refers to payments made from the Trump organization to former Trump fixer, Michael Cohen, in 2016 and 2017 to reimburse him for the payments that he had made to the porn star Stormy Daniels on the eve of the 2016 election. Now, fraudulent bookkeeping under New York State has a 2-year statute of limitations, and it is only a misdemeanor. Now, the way that Alvin Bragg, the Soros-funded prosecutor, who, just like the hack that he is, literally ran for office there in Manhattan on an explicit platform of prosecuting Trump in office. So the hack that he is, his attempt to simultaneously get around the statute of limitations problem while also upping it from a misdemeanor to a felony, is he says that this fraudulent bookkeeping, that is, the Trump organization wrote down these payments as legal services and not something else, is because that something else was allegedly the fact that these payments were made in direct furtherance of Donald Trump's 2016 presidential election. So what Alvin Bragg's theory of the case is that this fraudulent bookkeeping, marking it as legal payment to Michael Cohen, actually should have been recorded as a campaign finance violation, because that was what they were actually doing by paying off Stormy Daniels, the porn star. Now, there are more holes in this than your local supermarket's block of Swiss cheese. First of all, the campaign finance laws also have a statute of limitations, and that statute of limitations, based on anyone looking at this in a cursory fashion, that statute of limitations has told already. Now, again, the prosecutor's way out of this is that they say that there's a 1-year pause period for the tolling of the statute of limitations due to the COVID pandemic. Dubious, but maybe. Then another glaring problem is Alvin Bragg is a local prosecutor. A local prosecutor, can he even bring federal campaign finance charges? Isn't that a job for the federal prosecutors? Well, funny you should ask, because the SDNY, the Southern District of New York, the actual U.S. attorney, the federal prosecutor, actually looked previously into prosecuting Donald Trump on these exact same charges and ultimately concluded he wasn't going to do it because too much of a stretch. Do you know who also looked into these charges and decided he wasn't going to do it? Alvin Bragg's direct predecessor, another left-winger by the name of Cy Vance Jr. But Alvin Bragg has no such compunctions. So the testimony thus far has been heavily focused on David Pecker, the former head of the National Enquirer and its parent company. He has described in fairly lurid detail how they would engage in the so-called catch-and-kill scheme to purchase the exclusivity rights and a non-disclosure agreement to try to bury some unflattering stories about Donald Trump. Karen McDougal, another former Playboy playmate, her name has been brought up at trial. Trump allegedly had an affair with her. Who knows? Frankly, who cares? There's nothing illegal about a catch-and-kill scheme in journalism. It's a well-known tactic. There's nothing illegal at all. It's a legally enforceable non-disclosure agreement. So I'm not really sure what Alvin Bragg is trying to do here. I think on the one hand, what he's trying to do is just cynically advance his career up the totem pole. The way to get higher in Democratic Party politics in a very Democratic state like New York is to just be a left-wing hack, essentially, and to prosecute your political enemies, which is exactly what he's doing. And to the extent that he's trying to make an actual argument to the jurors at all, what he's really trying to do is not so much make this very less than persuasive, underwhelming legal argument about adding this onto that to get around the statute of limitations. No, he's really, if you read between the lines here, what he's actually doing, he's trying to relitigate the 2016 presidential election. That's what he's trying to do. You know why? Because libs and Dems have still never gotten over the 2016 election. Tune on, you know, turn on MSNBC to this day, Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, the whole clown brigade over there. They still talk about Russia collusion. They still say that Donald Trump's a Russian agent. Well, by saying that Donald Trump would not have gone into office in 2016 were it not for so-called hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, this is basically a sister conspiracy theory to the Russiagate hoax. That's essentially, I think, what it's doing. We'll see if it gets the jury to bite. I ultimately do not think it will. I am cautiously optimistic that you might get a juror here, and all it takes is one juror to get a hung jury in a mistrial. I am cautiously optimistic that that might happen. There are two actual lawyers on this jury pool. You have to think that at least one of them is going to start asking some serious questions about Alvin Bragg's legal theory of the case. Trump also had this big oral argument at the U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday about the scope of presidential immunity for criminal prosecution after a president leaves office. This is relevant because if he actually is immune from certain acts, then special counsel Jack Smith might not be able to pursue any of his charges, or at bare minimum, he would certainly have some charges dropped from his multi-count indictment there in Washington, D.C. last year. And Jack Smith's federal probe in D.C. is really the crown jewel of the Democrat lawfare complex. This is the one where they are putting a lot of their eggs in the basket. This is the one about overturning an election, the 2020 election, January 6th, insurrection, fraud against the United States. That's the juicy one. That's the sexy indictment there that all the Democrats all have their panties in a wad, and they are just absolutely just foaming at the mouth over Jack Smith's probe there in Washington, D.C. But after Thursday's oral argument, it looks like the justices are going to reverse, in all likelihood, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which had taken a very cramped view of presidential immunity. It looks like the U.S. Supreme Court is going to probably concoct, and I've been predicting this all along, they're probably going to devise some sort of middle ground remedy whereby some acts of a president, those that implicate a core constitutional Article II duty, that's one way of viewing it, those acts will definitely have immunity from future criminal prosecution, but other acts of a more strictly personal nature will not. So to drive home the point, surely there is a distinction between making a life or death decision about evacuating U.S. hostages overseas or sending in SEAL Team 6. You know, what if it goes wrong? One of the SEAL Team 6 members then wants to, you know, sue you afterwards for negligent homicide, whatever. Surely there is a legal distinction somewhere between that and immunity, that is, versus a president just deciding to go deep in the bowels of the dark web and finding some assassin to kill your mistress before your wife finds out. I mean, that's a very extreme example, but that's roughly, I think, the test that the Supreme Court is going to devise. All of this is going to ultimately then result, if I'm correct, in kicking it down to the lower courts, the trial court, for a fact-finding inquiry as to whether or not Jack Smith's charges, the actual allegations, fit bucket one or bucket two.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
We're going to come back in our Hammer Time segment to all the insanity on the left. But I think it is also important to talk about the state of the right. The American right, in many ways, is not in a particularly healthy state right now. And there are very few people with microphones who are willing to even talk about it. I think most of the folks out there, I'm not going to name names here, but most of the folks out there in this line of work are happy to just put on the cheerleader pom-poms and say, yay team, no matter what. We're all in it because we're on the same side. We wear the same jersey. We're the red team. They're the blue team, or whatever the colors may be. And just think of it as a very binary sports team-like mentality. And I think part of that is fair. America does have a two-party system. Attempts to disrupt the two-party system traditionally have not gone very far. And I don't think that that's changing anytime soon. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., RFK Jr., for example, has not exactly made it onto a lot of ballots thus far. Every time you have some sort of generation of interest for a third party, it just never goes anywhere. So we live in a two-party system. Okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean, that you can't be introspective and look at what is happening on your own side, especially when you see trouble brewing. And on this show, we have not been afraid to call it out. We have discussed how Tucker Carlson, since he and Fox News parted ways, has gone down a very dark direction. He recently had on this pastor from Bethlehem who was praising the Hamas jihadists after October 7th. He's been an anti-Israel, anti-Jewish activist for a long time. He lives in Bethlehem under the jackboot of the Palestinian Authority. He is a talking head propagandist for radical Muslims, this pastor, somewhat ironically. We have not been afraid on the show to talk about Candace Owens, that her whole spat with the Daily Wire, which thankfully resulted in long overdue fashion in her ouster from the Daily Wire. Well, one thing that Tucker and Candace have in common, and this is the subject that I really want to dwell on here, it's not the Jews. we're not going to talk more about the Jews. So it's actually not the Jews, although they perhaps have a certain level of skepticism or animus there in common as well. But it's something related, but a little different. I noticed Candace Owens tweeting this past week about the Germans in World War II. So you're probably sitting there listening, wait, Josh, this is not about the Jews? And she was making a point about the firebombing of Dresden. And look, I mean, Candace is a low IQ moron, so I can only kind of try to divine what her actual point was that she was getting at by sending these tweets. But she was calling attention to the persecution of the Germans and how they suffered unduly and how a lot of them were displaced after the war. I can't imagine why, by the way. They just tried to murder like the entire European continent. And then I thought back a little bit to Tucker Carlson's unusual recent stop to Moscow back in February. Not necessarily the fact that he interviewed Vladimir Putin and let Putin go on this wild 25-30 minute history rant that was an insane writing of revisionist history. But the fact that Tucker Carlson also went to the supermarket and he did this ridiculous propaganda video straight out of like a Bernie Sanders 1970s era honeymoon trip to the Hammer and Sickle era of Moscow, where Tucker was bragging about the supermarket technology. And then he went to the subway system. Oh my God, look at how beautiful the subway is here. Well, I mean, who do you think built the Moscow subway? It was quite literally gulag labor during the Soviet Union. So I think that's worth bearing in mind to you, Tucker Carlson. But it is this urge that I see from some on the dissident right, for lack of a better term. I don't like that term, but for lack of a better term, that's what I'll call it. You see this urge. You become so convinced that America is actually the enemy that you find yourself almost rooting for our actual enemies. Germany during World War II, God forbid. Russia and Putin today. I mean, on the true freak job extremes, you see this pertaining to Iran, although that's obviously more of a left-wing Islamist problem. And here is the category error. Here is the category error that I think these people are making. They are making a conflation between the American ruling class, which they properly loathe, which they have a dripping disdain for. So do I, by the way. So do I. But they are making a category error whereby they conflate the ruling class of the United States with the United States of America itself. The ruling class of this country is rotten. The ruling class is disproportionately comprised of people who went to the same boarding schools, who went to the same universities, who subscribed to the same globalist neoliberal ideology. They very much are there to subjugate those of us who think of ourselves as deplorables, to borrow the infamous Hillary Clinton language. There is no clearer manifestation of this than the World Economic Forum, the so-called Great Reset, and all that that entails. It is top-down authoritarian governance trying to alter your way of life for the worse. That is a just, righteous, and correct view of the state of things when it comes to the ruling class. But to hate our sordid state of affairs at the level of the ruling class is not to say that America itself is actually the enemy. Because America is not the enemy. You know, we do a lot of dumb things, like flying the rainbow flag at embassies around the world, flying the rainbow flag in the Vatican just to piss off religious Catholics. Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting stuff. Trying to teach women's liberation to the Taliban people in Kabul. I mean, the U.S. does a lot of absolutely dumb things. But don't lose the forest for the trees here, guys. Don't become like the Bernie Sanderses of the 1970s, back when Bernie literally honeymooned in the old USSR, and then he put a hammer and sickle flag in his mayor's office in Burlington, Vermont. The guy's a commie to his core. Don't do that. No matter what you might think of the current state of the American elite, no matter what you might think about the fact that both parties have fallen to terrible policies when it comes to outstripping manufacturing and selling it to China, or these moralistic war neoconservative boondoggles in Iraq, Afghanistan, whatever your objections might be, and I assure you that I harbor virtually all the same objections. This country still fundamentally, structurally speaking, is good. Our enemies, by and large, are bad. Do not forget that very, very important, basic but very important point.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are.
They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's Hammer Time.
Universities in Iowa are shutting down their DEI programs and increasing their civics education. So these are three universities in the Hawkeye State are shutting down their DEI offices. Here is what the University of Iowa's president, Barbara Wilson, has to say. Quote, "We will also be prohibiting anybody from requiring pronouns." Well, this is just fantastic. I mean, this is what you have to do in order to remake the cultural inroads in your state. Iowa very much is part of the conversation under the excellent, excellent governorship there of Kim Reynolds. They've got an all-star team in place there in Iowa. The Attorney General of the state of Iowa, Brenna Byrd. I've known Brenna for a while, actually. She's the first Republican Attorney General that Iowa has had in like 45 years or something crazy like that. Iowa is quickly becoming the Florida of the Midwest in many ways, although I guess Iowans might say that Florida is becoming the Iowa of the South. But the Kim Reynolds model of governance, which very closely mirrors the Ron DeSantis model of governance, the so-called Florida blueprint, is to not be silent, to not try to duck in cowardly fashion the great societal and civilizational battles of our day by saying, oh, we can't actually use political power there. Oh, this would be authoritarian, or this would be too much to try to use power to try to shape minds and inculcate virtue. No, you understand that statecraft, as the famous book from George Will many years ago said, statecraft actually can be soulcraft. You can use the levers of power to try to sculpt values and to change minds. And I'm making a very abstract point here, but that is exactly what is happening in our roiling debates over the efficacy, the propriety, and the ubiquity, or lack thereof, of the DEI regimes and the apparatus on campuses. If you believe, as you should, if you believe in equal justice under law, in the tenets of the Declaration of Independence, the Reconstruction Amendments, the Civil Rights Statutes from the 1960s, if you believe in someone no less than Martin Luther King Jr., who famously said, "Judge me not by the color of my skin, but the content of my character," you must be dedicated to eradicating the cancer that is so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion, which in practice amounts to anti-white racism, anti-Christian bigotry, anti-Jewish bigotry, and so forth. So good for the state of Iowa, which has become an absolute pillar in our roiling cold civil war in this country. Iowa and Florida, two of the tips of the spear of the right-wing cultural backlash against the current woke insanity that spreads like a cancer across our body politic. Oregon approved spending includes funds for LGBTQIA2S+ research. So the governor of Oregon, Tina Kotek, has approved $1.25 million for data about, you know, I'm not even going to bother to say that acronym again, but she's approved $1.25 million for data about these people in Oregon. Apparently, according to at least one study, Oregon has the highest per capita population of LGBTQ people of any state. They say it's 7.8%. I have no idea how you're supposed to even measure something like that. You're basically just taking someone's word that is how they choose to identify. It kind of reminds me actually very much of the book that my friend Abigail Schreier wrote a number of years ago, where she described the transgender phenomenon among teenage girls especially as a social contagion. Because you know what? It's a social contagion. It is a literal social contagion. I think back to this statistic I saw about the incoming freshman class at no less institution than Princeton University, the number one ranked school in the U.S. News World Report rankings basically every year. The incoming freshman class at Princeton University, it wasn't this past year, but it was the year before that. So I guess fall 2022, self-identified as like 37 or 38% LGBT. Don't tell me that all of these people necessarily have an irresistible urge to chop off Mr. Winky Wink or to have sexual relations with someone of the same gender that they were just born this way, as Lady Gaga said. No, all of this stuff, this LGBTQ stuff in general, how can you possibly understand it as anything other than a social contagion? But by the way here, going back to this acronym that I tried to muddle through, LGBTQIA2S. So I think 2S refers to so-called two-spirit. I still haven't figured out what two-spirit means. I don't even know what some of these other acronyms mean here. What a bunch of garbage. I mean, what a bunch of actual garbage here that we are dedicating specific funds, as the governor of Oregon has apparently seen fit to do, to dedicate research about people who identify as two-spirit. You know, how about you focus some funds there out there on the West Coast in Oregon on cleaning up the homeless garbage and the needle-infested downtown areas of Portland? How about you focus on actually making your state and your urban core in particular a better place to live again, you absolutely feckless moron? Tennessee approves bill punishing adults who help minors receive so-called gender-affirming care. So this law is expected to be signed by the governor, Bill Lee. He has also approved Tennessee's abortion ban. So Governor Bill Lee, again, speaking of red states, we're just talking about Iowa. Governor Bill Lee has been a generally very good governor there in Tennessee. He's done a couple of smaller things that I probably have some bones to pick. But overall, he has been one of the most effective and within his own state, more transformative conservative governors, in no small part due to his adoption of the very style and philosophy of governance that I was just talking about, which is you are rejecting this cowardly mentality that you have to just avoid the so-called culture war, and you're going to embrace it head on there. So, you know, this actually reminds me as well of a very interesting exchange that I heard at the U.S. Supreme Court this past week. So it wasn't the Donald Trump case. We spoke about that earlier in the program. There was actually a very different, interesting case that was argued at the U.S. Supreme Court this past Wednesday. It involved Idaho's strict abortion law, which bans most abortions there out in the state of Idaho. And what happened was, after the Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade back in 2022, you had the Biden administration via HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, they issued a guidance, kind of a dear colleague sort of letter, where they said that a 1986 statute referred to as EMTALA, this 1986 statute requires that any hospital accepting Medicare funds be able to perform emergency abortions. And the legal question was whether or not this was compatible with Idaho's strict abortion law. I say all that because there was a fascinating exchange in the oral argument at this particular case, where Justice Alito, the great conservative, essentially asked the Solicitor General of the United States, so the United States government's chief appellate advocate, her name's Liz Prolegar, Justice Alito asked Liz Prolegar whether or not there is ever such thing as an abortion that is medically necessary, an emergency abortion medically necessary because of mental health. And you know what Liz Prolegar said? The Solicitor General of the United States and the Joe Biden administration, no less, conceded that there is no such thing as a mentally required emergency abortion, because she said it is an issue there of so-called brain chemistry, was her word. If you are depressed, God forbid you are having suicidal ideation, it is an issue of brain chemistry where a physical remedy, that being the abortion, is not required. I say all that because you should take exactly what the Solicitor General of the United States just said there and apply it to gender dysphoria, apply it to so-called gender-affirming care. We are dealing here with mentally ill people and people who have gender dysphoria, which was recognized as a mental illness in the DSM fairly recently. There are psychological treatments there. You don't need to go ahead and chop off Mr. Winky Wink of a vulnerable, impressionable teenager in order to get there. So just wanted to make that point as well. Detroit journalist is examining the cash value of racism in a new book. So this is a new book out. It's called The White Bonus: Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. This book is the product of an 8-year process looking at the prison system, the public school system, healthcare. Oh, how it's all so systemically racist and how it all exists to oppress the oppressed class to the benefit, redounding to the benefit, that is, of the oppressor class. You know, look, if you're looking to for a fun prank to pull on your conservative friend, I suggest maybe you drop a copy of this book in their mailbox here. Again, the book is called The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. Who is the audience for this sort of drivel? I mean, I honestly don't know. I mean, does any like black person actually want to read this, or is this literally just writing for an audience of self-hating Upper West Side New York City liberals? I mean, that basically is the only audience for this. The Robin DiAngelo people, the white fragility folks, the folks who back during the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020 were literally washing the feet of black people to try to expiate the sins of the white race from like 300-400 years ago. I mean, that is the market for this utter sophistry and intellectually unsophisticated bullcrap there. I genuinely wonder whether actual black people could give a crap about books like this, because I personally have never spoken to a black person who was interested in reading books like this. It literally is just written for white virtue signaling Upper West Side idiots. Finally, the National LGBTQ Task Force has called for a ceasefire in Gaza. Well, isn't that quite funny? The task force says that its mission is to, quote, build power, take action, and create change to achieve freedom, justice, and equity for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, blah, blah, blah. Well, isn't that quite funny, though? What do these morons think is the policy when it comes to gay people and, I guess, transgender people, to the extent they exist, in Gaza? Do you think Hamas... what do you think Hamas is going to do if you have a young Arab kid who goes out on the street and announces to society, I'm gay, or I'm actually a girl, I want to dress a princess, give me a dress and some ballerina shoes, whatever. What do you think is going to happen to that kid? Nothing good. You know, the so-called Queers for Palestine, which is just the quintessence of the absolute inanity and moronic nature of the intersectional mentality in the far left in general, the so-called Queers for Palestine movement, I guess what I analogize it to is chickens for Chick-fil-A. You are literally advocating for your own destruction, death, and subjugation. Now, if you think that that is a good idea, I guess by all means go for it. But the final point I will make here is that these folks always eat their own. The revolution always comes back to eat their own. I saw a headline from Seattle, Washington, actually this past week, where at the University of Washington, the so-called Gaza encampment down, they shut it down because it had too many white people. Because it literally was led by too many white people, and like the Arabs and Muslims who were involved there, they were like, oh my God, like how do we get to a point where we're being like led by a bunch of whiteys here? So they shut it down. The revolution always eats its own. And that obviously is what you're seeing here in the so-called Queers for Palestine. These people are absolute imbeciles. Why don't you go to Gaza or go to Ramallah in the West Bank for that matter? Why don't you go there and why don't you see what it's like to actually be an openly gay person? I'll give you a hint. You're not going to like it.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.